gland.
4. The psychedelic pineal. Even before I began the melatonin study, my review of the literature indicated it might not be the spirit molecule. I wondered if the pineal gland made other compounds with psychedelic properties. However, while still in the early stages of my career, and well before I began outlining my DMT project, I quickly discovered how controversial these ideas could be. In 1982, I undertook a year of clinical psychopharmacology research training at the University of California in San Diego. While I concentrated mostly on the relationship between the thyroid gland and mood, I also learned everything I could about the pineal gland. One of my teachers was Dr. K, an authority on biological rhythms, melatonin, and sleep. Halfway through my fellowship training, I decided to share with him some of my nascent ideas about a psychedelic role for the pineal. We were walking along one of the innumerable halls of the San Diego Veterans Administration Hospital. Our conversation was rambling and wide-ranging. There was a pause, and I took the chance. "Do you think," I offered, "that the pineal might produce psychedelic compounds? It seems to have the right ingredients. Maybe it somehow mediates spontaneous psychedelic types of states. Psychosis, for example." I was hesitant to get much deeper than this and avoided mentioning my more controversial ideas about the pineal, that it played a role in more exotic states, such as near-death or mystical experiences. Dr. K stopped in his tracks and turned on his heels. His brow furrowed and he peered at me intently through his glasses. A palpable menace glinted from his eyes. "Oops," I thought. "Let me tell you this, Rick," he said very slowly and firmly. "The pineal has nothing to do with psychedelic drugs." That was the last time that year I said the words pineal and psychedelic in the same breath to anyone. Nevertheless, I continued examining the literature and began developing some of the theories that informed this book. Further study of other scientists' work and the results of my own later melatonin research added to the body of evidence upon which I drew in formulating the following proposals. These hypotheses are not proven, but they derive from scientifically valid data combined with spiritual and religious observations and teachings. Many of these ideas are testable using available tools and methods. The implications of these theories are profound and disturbing, but also create a context of hope and promise. The most general hypothesis is that the pineal gland produces psychedelic amounts of DMT at extraordinary times in our lives. Pineal DMT production is the physical representation of non-material or energetic processes. It provides us with a vehicle to consciously experience the movement of our life force in its most extreme manifestations. Specific examples of this phenomenon are the following. When our individual life force enters our fetal body, the moment in which we become truly human, it passes through the pineal and triggers the first primordial flood of DMT. Later, at birth, the pineal releases more DMT. In some of us, pineal DMT mediates the pivotal experiences of deep meditation, psychosis, and near-death experiences. As we die, the life force leaves the body through the pineal gland, releasing another flood of this psychedelic spirit molecule. The pineal gland contains the necessary building blocks to make DMT. For example, it possesses the highest levels of serotonin anywhere in the body, and serotonin is a crucial precursor for pineal melatonin. The pineal also has the ability to convert serotonin to tryptamine, a critical step in DMT formation. The unique enzymes that convert serotonin, melatonin, or tryptamine into psychedelic compounds also are present in extraordinarily high concentrations in the pineal. These enzymes, the methyltransferases, attach a methyl group, that is one carbon and three hydrogens, onto other molecules, thus methylating them. Simply methylate tryptamine twice, and we have dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. Because it possesses the high levels of the necessary enzymes and precursors, the pineal gland is the most reasonable place for DMT formation to occur. Surprisingly, no one has looked for DMT in the pineal. The pineal gland also makes other potentially mind-altering substances, the beta-carbolines. These compounds inhibit the breakdown of DMT by the body's monoamine oxidases, MAO. One of the most striking examples of how beta-carbolines work is ayahuasca. Certain plants that contain beta-carbolines are combined with other plants that contain DMT to make this psychedelic Amazonian brew, which allows the DMT to become orally active. If it weren't for the beta-carbolines, MAO in the gut would rapidly destroy this swallowed DMT, and it would have no effect on our minds. It is uncertain whether beta-carbolines by themselves are psychedelic. However, they do markedly enhance the effects of DMT. Thus, the pineal gland may produce both DMT and chemicals that magnify and prolong its effects. Under what circumstances might the pineal gland make DMT instead of the minimally psychoactive melatonin? For this to happen, there needs to be an overriding of one or more of the following constraints normally preventing pineal DMT production: the cellular security system around the pineal gland, the presence of an anti-DMT compound in the pineal gland, the low activity of the methyltransferase enzymes that produce DMT, and the efficiency of the monoamine oxidase enzymes breakdown of DMT. The guiding principle of the first wave of human DMT research was to compare DMT and schizophrenic states. Therefore, this was the context in which scientists studied these four different elements of the human DMT system. From these psychosis studies, we can extract data supporting my hypotheses about how the pineal may make DMT. My emphasis on the relationship between DMT and psychosis, therefore, is not because I believe that this is the only role for endogenous DMT. Rather, psychosis is the only naturally occurring altered state of consciousness for which we have any real data. I believe that other spontaneous psychedelic conditions, such as near-death and spiritual experiences, also share a similar relationship with endogenous DMT. Those studies, however, have yet to be performed. Most likely, the primary factor inhibiting excessive pineal DMT production is the supremely efficient pineal security system discussed in the last chapter. The best-known example of this defense is the difficulty we encounter when trying to stimulate daytime melatonin production. Adrenaline and noradrenaline, the neurotransmitters that stimulate nighttime melatonin formation, collectively are called catecholamines. Nerve cells nearly touching the pineal gland release these catecholamines, which activate specific receptors on pineal tissue and thus initiate melatonin synthesis. The adrenal glands also produce adrenaline and noradrenaline, releasing them into the bloodstream in response to stress. However, when blood-borne adrenal catecholamines approach the pineal, the nerve cells around the pineal immediately take up and dispose of them. Therefore, circumstances in which adrenal catecholamine release occurs, such as in times of stress or during exercise, don't stimulate daytime melatonin formation. We performed a research study that demonstrated this quite clearly. Elite athletes ran a high-altitude marathon, spending much of it above 10,000 feet. We measured melatonin before and after the race. For many of the runners, this was nearly a near-death experience. Yet melatonin levels in these athletes rose only to those observed at night during normal sleep. Hardly an explosion of brain chemistry. Nevertheless, we did see that it is possible to override the pineal's defense shield if the stress is great enough. Neuroscientists believe this barrier to pineal activation exists because it would be problematic for an animal to experience its environment as dark during daylight hours. Since the pineal normally releases melatonin only at night, daytime melatonin release would feel as if it were dark at the wrong time, and the animal would be disoriented. However, this explanation is weak. Daytime melatonin secretion is hardly dangerous enough to merit such a complex and efficient security system. Melatonin effects are not immediate, but rather take hours to days to materialize. In addition, daylight almost instantly suppresses melatonin production to near zero, returning the system to baseline before any internal disruptions occur. However, consider what might happen if stress easily triggered the pineal to produce DMT rather than melatonin. DMT is physically immobilizing and produces a flood of unexpected and overwhelming visual and emotional imagery. Certainly, frequent bursts of DMT release would be much more dangerous for an animal than would be those of melatonin. It may be that melatonin is so hard to make during the day because any breach in the pineal security system is intolerable. The pineal erects a barrier to inordinate stress that protects equally everything behind it. So, one set of circumstances in which pineal DMT may form is when stress-induced catecholamine output is just too great for the pineal shield to withstand. It also is possible that the pineal security system does not function normally in psychotic individuals. There are strong indirect data supporting this idea. Stress worsens hallucinations and delusions in psychotic patients. DMT levels in those patients are related to the degree of psychosis. The more intense the symptoms, the higher the levels of DMT. We know that DMT also rises in animals exposed to stress. More common levels of stress-induced catecholamines may overwhelm inadequate pineal defenses in psychosis, thus producing too much DMT. This DMT then brings on or worsens symptoms in psychotic patients. Another factor normally protecting the body from pineal production of psychedelic amounts of DMT resides within the pineal gland itself. A particular kind of small protein, first discovered in blood, has been shown to interfere with the activity of the DMT-forming enzymes. The pineal has quite high levels of this protein, a sort of anti-DMT. If this inhibitor itself were blocked, DMT formation is more likely. Where better to provide an anti-DMT for preventing potentially dangerous excessive DMT formation than where it is made? In the pineal gland. Data from psychosis research also support this contention. Individuals with schizophrenia received pineal gland extracts as an experimental treatment in the 1960s. Their symptoms improved markedly. The explanation for this finding was that the pineal extracts provided patients with an additional dose of the anti-DMT that their own pineal glands lacked. Thus, they were better able to combat pathologically high levels of DMT, and their psychotic symptoms improved. Two other possible breaks on DMT production in the pineal relate to enzymes, those that produce and those that break down the spirit molecule within the body. Researchers have found that the methyltransferase enzymes that form DMT are more active in schizophrenia than in normal conditions. This would raise production of DMT. Scientists looked at many human tissues for the source of this abnormal enzyme function, but unfortunately did not study the pineal gland. Finally, if the MAO system normally destroying DMT were defective, more DMT might linger and produce psychedelic, psychotic symptoms. MAO is less efficient in schizophrenics than in healthy volunteers, and it may be that schizophrenics do not clear DMT quickly enough from their systems. This also would result in DMT levels too high for normal mental function. While researchers examined MAO activity in several human tissues, they unfortunately did not assess pineal MAO activity in schizophrenia. Let's now consider less pathological, but also relatively common and naturally occurring altered states of awareness in which pineal DMT may play a role. Dream consciousness is one of these. The most likely time for us to dream is also the time at which melatonin levels are highest, that is, around 3 a.m. Since melatonin itself has such mild psychological effects, it suggests a role for another pineal compound, whose levels parallel those of melatonin. DMT is a likely prospect for such a substance. However, no one has looked at 24-hour DMT rhythms in normal volunteers in an attempt to relate DMT levels to dream intensity or frequency. Jace Calloway, Ph.D., has suggested that pineal-derived beta-carbolines may mediate dreams. While the uncertain psychological effects of the beta-carbolines shed some doubt on this hypothesis, pineal beta-carbolines certainly could, by virtue of their DMT-boosting effects, indirectly stimulate dream production. Meditation or prayer also may elicit deeply altered states of consciousness. Pineal DMT production could underlie these mystical or spiritual experiences. All spiritual disciplines describe quite psychedelic accounts of the transformative experiences whose attainment motivate their practice. Blinding white light, encounters with demonic and angelic entities, ecstatic emotions, timelessness, heavenly sounds, feelings of having died and being reborn, contacting a powerful and loving presence underlying all of reality. These experiences cut across all denominations. They also are characteristic of a fully psychedelic DMT experience. How might meditation evoke the pineal DMT response? Several meditative disciplines bring about an intense fine-tuning of attention and awareness. For example, one pointed focus on the breath. The brain's electrical activity, as measured by the electroencephalogram, reflects this synchronization or bringing together of brain activity. Many studies have reported that experienced meditators produce brainwave patterns that are slower and better organized than those found in everyday awareness. The deeper the meditation, the slower and stronger the waves. Other techniques supplement these attentional practices with methods like chanting. Chants, using words from ancient languages with supposedly unique spiritual properties, may cause profound psychological effects. Visualization practices, in which one builds up increasingly complex and dynamic images in the mind's eye, also can lead to blissful and sublime states of mind. In these conditions, there is a dynamic yet unmoving quality to the experience, like a standing wave in a river. It looks as if the wave is not moving at all while water rushes along on all sides of it. In fact, it is the rushing water that produces the wave, and those waves create a unique note or sound. Such wave phenomena, by their production of a particular note or sound associated with their frequency, establish wide-ranging and diffuse fields of influence. Objects within those fields vibrate sympathetically or with the same frequency, a phenomenon called resonance. An example of the powerful effects of resonance is when a particular note shatters a glass, even though the sound is not especially loud. The glass vibrates sympathetically or resonates at the same frequency as that of surrounding sound. Certain notes can create intolerable stress within the unique structure of the glass, and it bursts. In a similar way, meditative techniques using sound, sight, or the mind may generate particular wave patterns whose fields induce resonance in the brain. Millennia of human trial and error have determined that certain sacred words, visual images, and mental exercises exert uniquely desired effects. Such effects may occur because of the specific fields they generate within the brain. These fields cause multiple systems to vibrate and pulse at certain frequencies. We can feel our minds and bodies resonate with these spiritual exercises. Of course, the pineal gland also is buzzing at these same frequencies. A resonance process may occur in the pineal similar to that of the shattering glass, although not quite as destructive. The pineal begins to vibrate at frequencies that weaken its multiple barriers to DMT formation. The pineal cellular shield, enzyme levels, and quantities of anti-DMT. The end result is a psychedelic surge of the pineal spirit molecule, resulting in the subjective states of mystical consciousness. So far, we have looked at non-life-threatening situations, psychosis and spiritual experiences. Now we may turn to more dramatic instances that also are nearly always accompanied by psychedelic subjective realities, birth, near-death, and death experiences. It is no exaggeration to say that birth, near-death, and death are extraordinarily stressful events. The life force is doing all it can to sustain its struggling residents. Tremendous outpourings of stress-related hormones occur at these times, including the pineal-stimulating catecholamines, adrenaline, and noradrenaline. Let's start with the birth process. The birth experience is highly psychedelic for the unanesthetized mother. How much more so for the newborn? We know that DMT is present in newborn laboratory animals. There's no reason to believe it's not also present in newborn humans. However, no one has yet looked for DMT in human newborns or their mothers during delivery. Normal vaginal delivery produces an enormous outpouring of catecholamine release. The massive flooding of these stress hormones over the mother's and fetus's pineal glands may be enough to override the pineal defense system and set in motion DMT release. If the mother is anesthetized, catecholamine production is less, and the least occurs when the baby is delivered by cesarean section. Therefore, these latter two situations may result in less robust, if any, DMT release by mothers and babies' pineals. High levels of DMT at birth provide an explanation for a particular piece of conventional wisdom from psychedelic psychotherapy. According to Stanislav Grof, M.D., an LSD psychotherapist with unparalleled experience, much of what takes place during psychedelic therapy sessions is a reenactment of the birth process. He has found that those born by cesarean section are less able to let go in psychedelic therapy than those born vaginally. The presence of psychedelic levels of DMT at normal birth and inadequate levels during cesarean births due to too little stress hormone-induced DMT output may explain this finding. Perhaps in order to fully let go into any powerful emotional experience as adults, we need a baseline of a safe and secure resolution to our first naturally occurring high-dose DMT session, which accompanies the birth process. Otherwise, later, as an adult, exposure to such unusual and unexpected states throws us into a completely unfamiliar set of experiences, disorienting and frightening us. We lack a reliable history of such experiences ending successfully. Massive surges of stress hormones also mark the near-death experience, or NDE. Much of the literature on the NDE describes this as a mystical, psychedelic, overwhelming psychological experience. It also may be a time when the protective mechanisms of the pineal are flooded and otherwise inactive pathways to DMT production turn on. We know very little about the physiology of death itself. What happens to our bodies, our brains, and our minds when we die? How long is the process? Does it end when we stop breathing? Or is there a reason many traditions counsel us about when to move or bury the dead? Why are they concerned about not wanting to disturb residual consciousness? Thus, we also must consider decomposing pineal tissue's effects upon our consciousness, both near and after death. Pineal tissue in the dying or recently dead may produce DMT for a few hours, and perhaps longer, and could affect our lingering consciousness. While our dead brainwave readings are flat, who knows about our inner mental state at this time? To begin testing the hypothesis that decomposing pineal tissue produces psychedelic compounds, many years ago I collected pineal glands from about 10 human cadavers to which I had access at a local morgue. I sent them to another laboratory to measure DMT. Unfortunately, the brains were not fresh frozen or removed immediately at the time of death and placed into liquid nitrogen. This instant deep freeze stops all breakdown of tissues from that point onward. We found no DMT in these pineal glands. If there were any, it is possible the long delay in processing the tissue, several days in some cases, resulted in its loss before analysis. Finally, psychedelic drugs may affect the pineal gland, and thereby use it and DMT formation as an intermediary in their action. There are LSD receptors on the pineal gland, and mescaline raises serotonin levels in the pineal. Beta-carbolines accelerate melatonin formation, in addition to their previously described property of magnifying and prolonging DMT effects. And DMT is the most potent of several psychedelics that stimulate pineal melatonin production. DMT promoting the formation of its own possible building blocks is similar to the kindling process, in which a tiny match can start a huge bonfire. The match begins by burning paper, which then lights larger twigs. Burning twigs ignite branches until ultimately a raging blaze ensues. Similarly, the various circumstances we've discussed that are conducive to endogenous DMT production may begin with just a little bit of newly formed material. These conditions could begin a process of making even more by raising levels of necessary precursors. Finally, there is a flash point for a full psychedelic burst of pineal DMT. The psychedelic fire burns itself out after it has run its course and exhausted the supply of raw materials. This DMT hypothesis of pineal function allows us to tie up several loose ends left by the melatonin hypothesis of pineal function. One of these questions I have already discussed is why the pineal gland possesses such a potent defense system against stress. The melatonin hypothesis does not adequately answer this. The DMT hypothesis, however, provides a much more satisfactory explanation. That is, the body so ruthlessly defends the pineal gland so that we are not disabled by everyday levels of stress releasing psychedelic levels of DMT. Another mystery unsolved by the melatonin hypothesis relates to the pineal gland's unique location. The pineal gland is not even made of brain tissue. Rather, it comes from specialized cells originating in the roof of the fetal mouth. Why does it migrate in every one of us to the middle of the brain? From its unique perch, the pineal nearly touches visual and auditory sensory relay stations. The emotional centers of the limbic system surround it, and its position allows for instant delivery of its products directly into the cerebrospinal fluid. Traditionally, we believe that the placement of the pineal is such that it can respond best to lighting conditions. However, the route from the eyes to the pineal is curiously tortuous. Nerves from the eyes to the pineal actually exit the head and detour through the neck before returning to the pineal deep within the skull. It would be just as efficient for the gland to stay in the neck or upper spinal cord and release melatonin directly into the bloodstream as a way of notifying its host animal of lighting conditions. It may be the pineal's placement is necessary so that melatonin may best affect nearby important brain centers, such as the pituitary gland, which regulates reproductive function. But this requirement really does not demand a deep brain location for the pineal. Melatonin carried by the blood from somewhere else could do just as good a job, as is the case with ovary and adrenal gland hormones. Perhaps melatonin needs immediate access to cerebrospinal fluid, and that's why it hangs from the roof of a fluid-containing ventricle. However, the pineal gland releases melatonin in a steady stream lasting for many hours, and its effects develop over days and weeks. A hormone with melatonin's characteristics has no need for access to cerebrospinal fluid. Finally, melatonin's psychological properties are rather insignificant. These minor mind-altering effects do not justify immediate access to the colliculi and limbic system, the deep brain structures that regulate perceptions and emotions. Thus, the pineal does not need to be in the middle of the brain if this location were to support melatonin's role in our lives. If the pineal gland were producing DMT, however, that would certainly warrant its strategic location. A DMT release directly onto the visual, auditory, and emotional centers the pineal nearly touches would profoundly affect our inner experience. We would see, hear, feel, and think things in a way unimaginable to consider for melatonin. Because of its extraordinarily short lifespan of just a few minutes, DMT would also benefit from the small distances, only millimeters wide, between the pineal and important brain structures. It could diffuse directly onto these brain sites by way of the cerebrospinal fluid, without first having to enter the blood circulation. If DMT first entered the blood, MAO enzymes would destroy it long before it returned to the brain to exert its profound mental effects. These considerations also effectively dispense with one of the major objections to the DMT theory of psychosis, the lack of differences between DMT blood levels in normal volunteers and in patients with psychosis. We now see that DMT concentrations in forearm vein blood may have little to do with its effects at discrete brain sites, sites at which DMT is broken down nearly as quickly as it is produced. This reasoning further develops the idea that decomposing pineal tissue affects residual awareness after death. If this postmortem DMT emptied directly into the spinal fluid, simple diffusion is all it would take for it to attach to those sensory and emotional centers. A pumping heart would not be necessary. Now that we've discussed two theories of pineal gland function in humans, the melatonin model and the DMT model, it is time to venture into analyzing the implications of these opposing paradigms. In the last chapter, I described how the pineal gland, by way of melatonin, inhibits reproductive function. In this chapter, I hypothesize that pineal DMT opens our senses to profound psychedelic experiences. It is as if within the pineal gland there is a powerful dynamic or tension between the two roles it may play, one spiritual and the other sexual. It's fascinating to note that many religious disciplines believe celibacy is necessary to attain the highest spiritual states. The explanation for this idea is that sexual activity diverts the energy required for full spiritual development. One chooses either the life of the flesh or the life of the spirit. Nevertheless, celibacy isn't consistent with reproduction, and there is a conflict between the continuity of the species and the anti-sexual attainment of reaching the greatest flowering of the individual spirit. This conflict may be played out biologically in the pineal gland. Valuable resources may go to the formation of either the reproductively important melatonin or the spiritually indispensable DMT, the hormone of darkness, or the chemical of inner light. However, this opposition may be more apparent than real. Consider the possibility that pineal DMT release mediates sexual ecstasy, resulting from the strenuous exertion, hyperventilation, and intense emotions of the sex act. Psychedelic features do emerge at orgasm. In fact, the highly pleasurable effects of sexually activated DMT production may be one of the major factors motivating reproductive behavior. Practitioners of Tantra attempt to achieve the best of both these worlds. This spiritual discipline recognizes that sexual excitation and orgasm produce highly ecstatic states, and therefore uses sexual intercourse as a meditative technique. By combining sex and meditation, tantric practitioners access states of consciousness not available with either practice alone. Pineal DMT release, stimulated by both deep meditation and intense sexual activity, may then result in especially pronounced psychedelic effects. There is a third element that ties together reproduction and higher consciousness, the energetic matrix within which is played out these competing pineal priorities. This is spirit, or life force. It is difficult to introduce the concept of spirit into any discussion of science in general, or biology in particular. However, it is even more difficult not to do so when the phenomena beg for it. In order to deal directly and deeply with the issues raised by the material I have presented, we must address this issue. How do we define the spirit? Compare life and death, the state of being alive, to that of being dead. One moment we are thinking, moving, and feeling. Cells are dividing, replacing dying ones with fresh recruits for the liver, lung, skin, and heart. The next moment, we are no longer breathing. Our heart has pumped its last beat. What is the difference? What's gone that was just there? There is something that enlivens us when joined with our body, when present in matter. It shows itself by way of movement and heat. In the brain, it provides the power to receive and transform into awareness our thoughts, feelings, and perceptions. When it is gone, the light is extinguished, and the engine stops. Whatever it is, the presence of this enlivening force provides us the opportunity to interact with this time and place. While not personal, this spirit or life force has a history associated with our particular collection of animated matter. It has experienced things with us while being essentially unchanged by those events. Its movements have created unique fields of influence by the notes or sounds it has generated by our body's mental and physical activities. When the body is too weak to contain it, it leaves. Some goes to other matter, and some joins the ambient background of fields. The unique fields produced by its cleaving to our body, however, remain for a while before dissipating. The stronger the field, or the louder the note, the more time it takes to fade. One of the most powerful reasons for my fascination with the pineal gland relates to its function in the life of the spirit. The importance and potential of this was brought home to me when, as a medical student in the mid-1970s, I learned of a startling coincidence involving the pineal gland and Buddhist beliefs about reincarnation. I cannot overemphasize how strong an impression this discovery made on me, and how it strengthened my search for a spiritual role for the pineal gland, and within it, the spirit molecule. I already knew that the Tibetan Buddhist Book of the Dead teaches that it takes 49 days for the soul of the recently dead to reincarnate. That is, 7 weeks from the time of death of one person elapses until the life force's rebirth into its next body. I remember very clearly, several years later, feeling the chill along my spine when, reading my textbook of human fetal development, I discovered this same 49-day interval marking two landmark events in human embryo formation. It takes 49 days from conception for the first signs of the human pineal to appear. 49 days is also when the fetus differentiates into male or female gender. Thus, the soul's rebirth, the pineal, and the sexual organs all require 49 days before they manifest. I unearthed this synchronicity when I was in my early 20s. I didn't know exactly how to make sense of it at the time. I still do not. In fact, conjectures relating far-flung phenomena based upon similarities in time may be as much wishful thinking as the old herbal doctrine of signatures, which suggested that an herb's properties depended upon how it looked. If a plant looked like a heart, it must be good for heart disease. What I'm proposing is almost a doctrine of elapsed time. If Buddhist text and human embryology reveal that different developments require 49 days, the events must be related. This association is perhaps logically shaky, but also intuitively appealing. How might the anatomical emergence of the pineal and the reproductive organs 49 days after conception involve the spiritual or life force? As we die, if near-death experiences are any indication, there is a profound shift in consciousness away from identification with the body. Pineal DMT makes available those particular non-embodied contents of consciousness. All the factors previously described combine for one final burst of DMT production: catecholamine release, decreased breakdown and increased formation of DMT, reduced anti-DMT, and decomposing pineal tissue. Therefore, it may be that the pineal is the most active organ in the body at the time of death. Might we say that the life force therefore exits the body through the pineal? The consequence of this flood of DMT upon our dying brain-based mind is a pulling back of the veils, normally hiding what Tibetan Buddhists call the bardo, or intermediary states between this life and the next. DMT opens our inner senses to these betwixt states with their myriad visions, thoughts, sounds, and feelings. As the body becomes totally inert, consciousness has completely left the body and now exists as a field among many fields of manifest things. The spirit molecule has outlived its usefulness as a scout for these realms. It has led us to the other shore, and we are on our own. During the next 49 days, we use our will or intent to process our unique life's signature, the accumulated experiences, memories, habits, tendencies, and feelings of the life that has ended. This conscious contending with our personal histories, where complete, results in a joining of those fields with ambient ones. It is as if a bell has been rung. The sound, loud at first, joins background noise, then gradually fades away. What is left over settles onto the next physical life form that seems most appropriate for subsequent processing of unresolved issues. There is a resonance, a sympathetic vibration of similar fields. C minor gravitates to C minor, animal traits to animals, plant qualities to plants, human issues to humans. In the case of human beings, these unmetabolized tendencies, this unfinished business, can enter the fetus only when it is ready. This readiness may require 49 days too, and may take the form of a pineal gland able to synthesize DMT. The pineal could act as an antenna or lightning rod for the soul, and sexual differentiation into male or female, occurring at exactly the same moment, provides the biological framework through which the life force now may assert itself. The movement of this energy, the residual life force of the past into the present, through the pineal and into the fetus, might be the first and most primordial DMT flash. This is the dawning of consciousness, of mind, of awareness as a distinct biological and sexual entity. The blinding light of pineal DMT, secreted within the developing brain, marks the passage through this threshold. Until this 49-day watershed, the fetus may be only a physical rather than a physical-spiritual being. Therefore, is 49 days when we truly can consider a fetus to be an individual, sentient, and therefore spiritual entity? This chapter suggests that naturally occurring altered states of consciousness result from high levels of pineal DMT production. However, what might happen if someone does not have a pineal gland, due to pineal cancer or a stroke destroying it? Would he or she have the same access to conscious experiences from endogenous DMT as someone with an intact pineal? The enzymes and precursors in the pineal gland are not unique to it, but the high concentrations of these compounds and the gland's remarkably convenient location make it an ideal source of the spirit molecule. Lung, liver, blood, eye, and brain all possess the appropriate raw materials for DMT production. In fact, for some years, researchers jokingly referred to schizophrenia as a lung disease, because of the high concentrations of DMT-forming enzymes within the lung. These other organs may produce DMT when the same sets of circumstances exist as those that would stimulate the pineal to do so. As radical as these theories were, I believed they could be tested using the traditional scientific method, designing experiments, analyzing data, and redefining the theories based upon results of this step-by-step research. So the next step in this hypothesis-building process was to determine if DMT given to people reproduced the features of those experiences. If outside-administered DMT elicited effects similar to those presumably resulting from inner-produced DMT, such as near-death and mystical states, my hypothesis would be much stronger. Therefore, I needed to find some way to perform a human research study with DMT. However, I was studying melatonin, and this pineal hormone's effects scarcely resembled those of DMT. Further studies into melatonin's physiology seemed futile. A paper I wrote in San Diego on adverse reactions to psychedelics, published while I was performing the Melatonin Project, drew the attention of Rick Doblin, a tireless fund and consciousness raiser for psychedelic drug research. He invited me to a conference in 1985 where I met the major figures of the psychedelic research and therapy field. Representatives from a wide variety of disciplines joined together for wide-ranging, far-reaching discussions about what to make of and do with the psychedelic experience. These new colleagues provided support, inspiration, valuable experience, and crucial information. They made it much easier to begin conceptualizing how a psychedelic research project actually might look. In 1987, my University of New Mexico mentor, Glenn Peake, died suddenly on a snowy Christmas day while returning from his morning run. Saddened and grieving, I saw my research trajectory waver. There had been a split between the research I believed was respectable and what I personally felt most inclined to study. There was my melatonin research, and then there was my interest in psychedelics. Glenn's premature death hastened the closing of that gap. During his memorial service, I remembered some of his most direct advice. Do what you really want in research. Who cares what other people think? I decided to stop my melatonin research and attempt a DMT project. I talked these ideas over with the chairman, directors, and heads of the university divisions supporting my melatonin experiments. They all believed a change in fields involved a real but reasonable risk. However, all were supportive of a psychedelic research project, if that's what you really want to do. The years of preparation were over. It was now or never. It was 1988.